remains of the Nandor whom he led away down Anduin. Some, it is said, dwelt age-long in the woods of the Vale of the Great River. Some came at last to its mouths, and there dwelt by the sea, and yet others, passing by Ered Nimraes, the White Mountains, came north again and entered the wilderness of Eriador, between Ered Luin and the far mountains of Mist. Now these were a woodland people, and had no weapons of steel, and the coming of the fell beasts of the north filled them with great fear, as the Naugrim declared to King Thingol in Menegroth. Therefore, Denethor, the son of Lenwe, hearing rumour of the might of Thingol and his majesty, and of the peace of his realm, gathered such host of his scattered people as he could, and led them over the mountains into Beleriand. There they were welcomed by Thingol, as kin long lost that returned, and they dwelt in Osiriand, the land of seven rivers. Of the long years of peace that followed after the coming of Denethor, there is little tale. In those days, it is said, Daeron, the minstrel, chief lawmaster of the kingdom of Thingol, devised his runes. And the Naugrim that came to Thingol learned them, and were well pleased with the device, esteeming Daeron's skill higher than did the Sindar, his own people. By the Naugrim, the Kyrth were taken east over the mountains and passed into the knowledge of many peoples. But they were little used by the Sindar for the keeping of records until the days of the war, and much that was held in memory perished in the ruins of Doriath. But of bliss and glad life there is little to be said before it ends. As works fair and wonderful, while still they endure for eyes to see, are their own record, and only when they are in peril or broken for ever do they pass into song. In Beleriand in those days the elves walked, and the rivers flowed, and the stars shone, and the night flowers gave forth their scents. And the beauty of Melian was as the noon, and the beauty of Luthien was as the dawn in spring. In Beleriand King Thingol upon his throne was as the lords of the Maiar, whose power is at rest, whose joy is as an air that they breathe in all their days, whose thought flows in a tide untroubled from the heights to the deeps. In Beleriand still at times rode Orime the Great, passing like a wind over the mountains, and the sound of his horn came down the leagues of the starlight, and the elves feared him for the splendour of his countenance and the great noise of the onrush of Nahar. But when the Valaroma echoed in the hills, they knew well that all evil things were fled far away. But it came to pass at last that the end of bliss was at hand, and the noontide of Valinor was drawing to its twilight. For as has been told, and as is known to all, being written in lore and sung in many songs, Melkor slew the trees of the Valar with the aid of Ungoliant, and escaped, and came back to Middle-earth. Far to the north befell the strife of Morgoth and Ungoliant. But the great cry of Morgoth echoed through Beleriand, and all its people shrank with fear. For though they knew not what it foreboded, they heard then the herald of death. Soon afterwards Ungoliant fled from the north and came into the realm of King Thingol, and the terror of darkness was about her. But by the power of Melian she was stayed, and entered not into Neldoreth, but abode long time under the shadow of the precipices in which Dorthonion fell southward. And they became known as Ered Gorgoroth, the Mountains of Terror, and none dared to go thither, or pass nigh them. There life and light were strangled, and there all waters were poisoned. But Morgoth, as has before been told, returned to Angband and built it anew. And above its doors he reared the reeking towers of Thangorodrim, and the gates of Morgoth were but 150 leagues distant from the bridge of Menegroth, far and yet all too near. Now the orcs that multiplied in the darkness of the earth grew strong and fell, and their dark lord filled them with a lust of ruin and death. And they issued from Angband's gates under the clouds that Morgoth sent forth, and passed silently into the highlands of the north. Thence, on a sudden, a great army came into Beleriand, and assailed King Thingol. Now, in his wide realm, many elves wandered free in the wild, or dwelt at peace in small kindreds far sundered, and only about Menigroth, in the midst of the land, and along the Falas, in the country of the mariners, were there numerous peoples. But the orcs came down upon either side of Menigroth, and from camps in the east between Kelon and Gelion, and west in the plains between Sirion and Narog, they plundered far and wide. And Thingol was cut off from Círdan at Eglarest. Therefore he called upon Denethor, and the elves came in force from Region beyond Aros and from Osiriand, and fought the first battle in the wars of Beleriand. And the eastern host of the orcs was taken between the armies of the Eldar north of the Andram and midway between Aros and Gelion, and there they were utterly defeated, and those that fled north from the great slaughter were waylaid by the axes of the Naugrim that issued from Mount Dolmed. Few indeed returned to Angband. But the victory of the elves was dear bought, for those of Osiriand were light-armed and no match for the orcs, who were shod with iron and iron-shielded and bore great spears with broad blades, and Denethor was cut off and surrounded upon the hill of Amon Ereb. There he fell, and all his nearest kin about him, before the host of Thingol could come to his aid. Bitterly though his fall was avenged, when Thingol came upon the rear of the orcs and slew them in heaps, his people lamented him ever after, and took no king again. After the battle some returned to Osiriand, and their tidings filled the remnant of their people with great fear, so that thereafter they came never forth in open war, but kept themselves by wariness and secrecy. And they were called the Lyquendi, the Green Elves, because of their raiment of the colour of leaves. But many went north and entered the guarded realm of Thingol, and were merged with his people. And when Thingol came again to Menigroth, he learned that the orc host in the west was victorious, and had driven Círdan to the rim of the sea. Therefore he withdrew all his people that his summons could reach within the fastness of Neldoreth and Region. And Melian put forth her power and fenced all that dominion round about with an unseen wall of shadow and bewilderment, the girdle of Melian, that none thereafter could pass against her will or the will of King Thingol, unless one should come with a power greater than that of Melian the Maia. And this inner land, which was long named Eglador, was after called Doriath, the guarded kingdom, land of the girdle. Within it there was yet a watchful peace, but without there was peril and great fear, and the servants of Morgoth roamed at will, save in the walled havens of the Falas. But new tidings were at hand, which none in Middle-earth had foreseen, neither Morgoth in his pits, nor Melian in Menigroth. For no news came out of Amon, whether by messenger, or by spirit, or by vision in dream, after the death of the trees. In this same time, Feanor came over the sea in the white ships of the Teleri, and landed in the firth of Drengist, and there burned the ships at Losgar. Of the Sun and Moon, and the Hiding of Valinor. It is told that after the flight of Melkor, the Valar sat long unmoved upon their thrones in the Ring of Doom. But they were not idle, as Feanor declared in the folly of his heart. For the Valar may work many things with thought rather than with hands, and without voices, in silence, they may hold counsel one with another. Thus they held vigil in the night of Valinor, and their thought passed back beyond Ea, and forth to the End. Yet neither wisdom nor power assuaged their grief, and the knowing of evil in the hour of its being. And they mourned not more for the death of the trees than for the marring of Feanor, of the works of Melkor, one of the most evil. For Feanor was made the mightiest in all parts of body and mind, in valor, in endurance, in beauty, in understanding, in skill, in strength, and in subtlety alike, of all the children of Ilúvatar, and a bright flame was in him. The works of wonder for the glory of Arda that he might otherwise have wrought, only Manwë might in some measure conceive. And it was told by the Vanyar, who held vigil with the Valar, that when the messengers declared to Manwë the answers of Feanor to his heralds, Manwë wept and bowed his head. But at that last word of Feanor, that at the least the Noldor should do deeds to live in song forever, he raised his head as one that hears a voice far off, and he said, "So shall it be. Dear bought those songs shall be accounted, and yet shall be well bought, for the price could be no other. Thus even as Eru spoke to us, shall beauty not before conceived be brought into Ea, and evil yet be good to have been." But Mandos said, "And yet remain evil. To me shall Feanor come soon." But when at last the Valar learned that the Noldor had indeed passed out of Aman and were come back into Middle-earth, they arose and began to set forth in deeds those counsels which they had taken in thought for the redress of the evils of Melkor. Then Manwë bade Yavanna and Nienna to put forth all their powers of growth and healing, and they put forth all their powers upon the trees. But the tears of Nienna availed not to heal their mortal wounds, and for a long while Yavanna sang alone in the shadows. Yet even as hope failed and her song faltered, Telperion bore at last upon a leafless bough one great flower of silver, and Laurelin a single fruit of gold. These Yavanna took, and then the trees died, and their lifeless stems stand yet in Valinor, a memorial of vanished joy. But the flower and the fruit Yavanna gave to Aule, and Manwë hallowed them, and Aule and his people made vessels to hold them and preserve their radiance, as is said in the Narsilion, the Song of the Sun and Moon. These vessels the Valar gave to Varda, that they might become lamps of heaven, outshining the ancient stars, being nearer to Arda. And she gave them power to traverse the lower regions of Ilmen, and set them to voyage upon appointed courses above the girdle of the earth, from the west unto the east, and to return. These things the Valar did, recalling in their twilight the darkness of the lands of Arda, and they resolved now to illumine Middle-earth, and with light to hinder the deeds of Melkor. For they remembered the Avari that remained by the waters of their awakening, and they did not utterly forsake the Noldor in exile. And Manwë knew also that the hour of the coming of men was drawn nigh. And it is said indeed that even as the Valar made war upon Melkor for the sake of the Quendi, so now for that time they forbore for the sake of the Hildor, the aftercomers, the younger children of Ilúvatar. For so grievous had been the hurts of Middle-earth in the war upon Utumno, that the Valar feared lest even worse should now befall. Whereas the Hildor should be mortal and weaker than the Quendi to withstand fear and tumult. Moreover, it was not revealed to Manwë where the beginning of men should be, north, south, or east. Therefore, the Valar sent forth light, but made strong the land of their dwelling. Isil the Sheen, the Vanyar of old, named the moon, flower of Telperion in Valinor. And Anar the fire-golden, fruit of Laurelin, they named the sun. But the Noldor named them also Rana, the wayward, and Vazar, the heart of fire that awakens and consumes. For the sun was set as a sign for the awakening of men and the waning of the elves, but the moon cherishes their memory. The maiden whom the Valar chose from among the Maiar to guide the vessel of the sun was named Arion, and he that steered the island of the moon was Tilion. In the days of the trees, Arion had tended the golden flowers in the gardens of Varna and watered them with the bright dews of Laurelin. But Tilion was a hunter of the company of Orime, and he had a silver bow. He was a lover of silver, and when he would rest, he forsook the woods of Orime, and going into Lorien, he lay in dream by the pools of Este, in Telperion's flickering beams, and he begged to be given the task of tending forever the last flower of silver. Arion the maiden was mightier than he, and she was chosen because she had not feared the heats of Laurelin, and was unhurt by them, being from the beginning a spirit of fire whom Melkor had not deceived nor drawn to his service. Too bright were the eyes of Arion for even the Eldar to look on, and leaving Valinor, she forsook the form and raiment which, like the Valar, she had worn there, and she was as a naked flame, terrible in the fullness of her splendour. Isil was first wrought and made ready, and first rose into the realm of the stars, and was the elder of the new lights, as was Telperion of the trees. Then for a while the world had moonlight, and many things stirred and woke that had waited long in the sleep of Yavanna. The servants of Morgoth were filled with amazement, but the elves of the outer lands looked up in delight, and even as the moon rose above the darkness in the west, Fingolfin let blow his silver trumpets and began his march into Middle-earth, and the shadows of his host went long and black before them. Tilion had traversed the heaven 7 times, and thus was in the furthest east when the vessel of Arion was made ready. Then Anar arose in glory, and the first dawn of the sun was like a great fire upon the towers of the Pelori. The clouds of Middle-earth were kindled, and there was heard the sound of many waterfalls. Then indeed Morgoth was dismayed, and he descended into the uttermost depths of Angband, and withdrew his servants, sending forth great reek and dark cloud to hide his land from the light of the day-star. Now Varda purposed that the 2 vessels should journey into Ilmen, and ever be aloft, but not together. Each should pass from Valinor into the east and return, the one issuing from the west as the other turned from the east. Thus the first of the new days were reckoned after the manner of the trees, from the mingling of the lights when Arion and Tilion passed in their courses, above the middle of the earth. But Tilion was wayward and uncertain in speed, and held not to his appointed path. And he sought to come near to Arion, being drawn by her splendour, though the flame of Anar scorched him, and the island of the moon was darkened. Because of the waywardness of Tilion, therefore, and yet more because of the prayers of Lorien and Este, who said that sleep and rest had been banished from the earth, and the stars were hidden, Varda changed her counsel, and allowed a time wherein the world should still have shadow and half-light. Anar rested therefore a while in Valinor, lying upon the cool bosom of the outer sea, and evening, the time of the descent and resting of the sun, was the hour of greatest light and joy in Aman. But soon the sun was drawn down by the servants of Ulmo, and went then in haste under the earth, and so came unseen to the east, and there mounted the heaven again, lest night be overlong and evil walk under the moon. But by Anar the waters of the outer sea were made hot and glowed with coloured fire, and Valinor had light for a while after the passing of Arion. Yet as she journeyed under the earth and drew towards the east, the glow faded, and Valinor was dim, and the Valar mourned then most for the death of Laurelin. At dawn the shadows of the mountains of defence lay heavy on the blessed realm. Varda commanded the moon to journey in like manner, and passing under earth to arise in the east, but only after the sun had descended from heaven. But Tilion went with uncertain pace, as yet he goes, and was still drawn towards Arion, as he shall ever be. So that often both may be seen above the earth together, or at times it will chance that he comes so nigh that his shadow cuts off her brightness, and there is a darkness amid the day. Therefore, by the coming and going of Anar, the Valar reckoned the days thereafter, until the change of the world. For Tilion tarried seldom in Valinor, but more often would pass swiftly over the western land, over Avathar, or Araman, or Valinor, and plunge in the chasm beyond the outer sea, pursuing his way alone amid the grots and caverns at the roots of Arda. There he would often wander long, and late he would return. Still, therefore, after the long night, the light of Valinor was greater and fairer than upon Middle-earth. For the sun rested there, and the lights of heaven drew nearer to earth in that region. But neither the sun nor the moon can recall the light that was of old, that came from the trees before they were touched by the poison of Ungoliant. That light lives now in the Silmarils alone. But Morgoth hated the new lights, and was for a while confounded by this unlooked-for stroke of the Valar. Then he assailed Tilion, sending spirits of shadow against him, and there was strife in Ilmen beneath the paths of the stars. But Tilion was victorious, and Arion Morgoth feared with a great fear, but dared not come nigh her, having indeed no longer the power. For as he grew in malice and sent forth from himself the evil that he conceived in lies and creatures of wickedness, his might passed into them and was dispersed. And he himself became ever more bound to the earth, unwilling to issue from his dark strongholds. With shadows he hid himself and his servants from Arion, the glance of whose eyes they could not long endure. And the lands near his dwelling were shrouded in fumes and great clouds. But seeing the assault upon Tilion, the Valar were in doubt, fearing what the malice and cunning of Morgoth might yet contrive against them. Being unwilling to make war upon him in Middle-earth, they remembered nonetheless the ruin of Almaren, and they resolved that the like should not befall Valinor. Therefore at that time they fortified their land anew, and they raised up the mountain walls of the Pelori to sheer and dreadful heights, east, north, and south. Their outer sides were dark and smooth, without foothold or ledge, and they fell in great precipices with faces hard as glass, and rose up to towers with crowns of white ice. A sleepless watch was set upon them, and no pass led through them, save only at the Kalakiria. But that pass the Valar did not close, because of the Eldar that were faithful, and in the city of Tirion upon the green hill Finarfin yet ruled the remnants of the Noldor in the deep cleft of the mountains. For all those of elven race, even the Vanya and Ingwe, their lord, must breathe at times the outer air and the wind that comes over the sea from the lands of their birth. And the Valar would not sunder the Teleri wholly from their kin. But in the Kalakiria they set strong towers and many sentinels, and at its issue upon the plains of Valmar a host was encamped, so that neither bird nor beast nor elf nor man nor any creature beside that dwelt in Middle-earth could pass that leaguer. And in that time also, which songs call Nurtale Valinoreva, the hiding of Valinor, the enchanted isles, was set, and all the seas about them were filled with shadows and bewilderment. And these isles were strung as a net in the shadowy seas from the north to the south, before Tol Eressia, the lonely isle, is reached by one sailing west. Hardly might any vessel pass between them, for in the dangerous sounds the waves sighed for ever upon dark rocks shrouded in mist. And in the twilight a great weariness came upon mariners and a loathing of the sea. but all that ever set foot upon the islands were there entrapped, and slept until the change of the world. Thus it was that, as Mandos foretold to them in Ahriman, the blessed realm was shut against the Noldor. And of the many messengers that in after days sailed into the west, none came ever to Valinor, save one only, the mightiest mariner of song. Of Men. The Valar sat now behind their mountains at peace, and having given light to Middle-earth, they left it for long untended, and the lordship of Morgoth was uncontested save by the valor of the Noldor. Most in mind Ulmo kept the exiles, who gathered news of the earth through all the waters. From this time forth were reckoned the years of the sun. Swifter and briefer are they than the long years of the trees in Valinor. In that time the air of Middle-earth became heavy with the breath of growth and mortality, and the changing and aging of all things was hastened exceedingly. Life teemed upon the soil and in the waters in the second spring of Arda, and the Eldar increased, and beneath the new sun Beleriand grew green and fair. At the first rising of the sun, the younger children of Ilúvatar awoke in the land of Hildorian, in the eastward regions of Middle-earth. But the first sun arose in the west, and the opening eyes of men were turned towards it, and their feet, as they wandered over the earth for the most part, strayed that way. The Atani they were named by the Eldar, the second people, but they called them also Hildor the followers, and many other names: Apanona the afterborn, Engwar the sickly, and Firima the mortals. And they named them the usurpers, the strangers, and the inscrutable, the self-cursed, the heavy-handed, the night-fearers, the children of the sun. Of men little is told in these tales which concern the eldest days before the waxing of mortals and the waning of the elves, save of those fathers of men, the Atanatari, who in the first years of the sun and moon wandered into the north of the world. To Hildorian there came no Valar to guide men, or to summon them to dwell in Valinor. And men have feared the Valar rather than loved them, and have not understood the purposes of the powers, being at variance with them and at strife with the world. Ulmo nonetheless took thought for them, aiding the counsel and will of Manwë, and his messages came often to them by stream and flood. But they have not skill in such matters, and still less had they in those days before they had mingled with the elves. Therefore they loved the waters, and their hearts were stirred. But they understood not the messages. Yet it is told that ere long they met dark elves in many places, and were befriended by them. And men became the companions and disciples in their childhood of these ancient folk, wanderers of the elven race, who never set out upon the paths to Valinor, and knew of the Valar only as a rumour and a distant name. Morgoth had then not long come back into Middle-earth, and his power went not far abroad, and was moreover checked by the sudden coming of great light. There was little peril in the lands and hills, and there were new things devised long ages before in the thought of Yavanna, and sown a seed in the dark, came at last to their budding and their bloom. West, north, and south, the children of men spread and wandered, and their joy was the joy of the morning before the dew is dry, when every leaf is green. But the dawn is brief, and the day full often belies its promise. And now the time drew on to the great wars of the powers of the north, when Noldor and Sindar and Men strove against the hosts of Morgoth Bauglir, and went down in ruin. To this end, the cunning lies of Morgoth that he sowed of old, and sowed ever anew among his foes, and the curse that came of the slaying at Al-Qualandë, and the oath of Feanor were ever at work. Only a part is here told of the deeds of those days, and most is said of the Noldor and the Silmarils, and the mortals that became entangled in their fate. In those days, elves and men were of like stature and strength of body, but the elves had greater wisdom and skill and beauty. And those who had dwelt in Valinor and looked upon the powers as much surpassed the dark elves in these things, as they in turn surpassed the people of mortal race. Only in the realm of Doriath, whose queen Melian was of the kindred of Valar, did the Sindar come near to match the Kalaquendi of the Blessed Realm. Immortal were the elves, and their wisdom waxed from age to age, and no sickness nor pestilence brought death to them. Their bodies, indeed, were of the stuff of earth, and could be destroyed. And in those days they were more like to the bodies of men, since they had not so long been inhabited by the fire of their spirit, which consumes them from within in the courses of time. But men were more frail, more easily slain by weapon or mischance, and less easily healed, subject to sickness and many ills, and they grew old and died. What may befall their spirits after death, the elves know not. Some say that they too go to the halls of Mandos. But their place of waiting there is not that of the elves. And Mandos, under Ilúvatar alone, save Manwë, knows whither they go after the time of recollection in those silent halls beside the outer sea. None have ever come back from the mansions of the dead, save only Beren, son of Barahir, whose hand had touched a Silmaril. But he never spoke afterwards to mortal men. The fate of men after death, maybe, is not in the hands of the Valar, nor was all foretold in the music of the Ainur. In after days, when because of the triumph of Morgoth, elves and men became estranged, as he most wished, those of the elven race that lived still in Middle-earth waned and faded, and men usurped the sunlight. Then the Quendi wandered in the lonely places of the great lands and the isles, and took to the moonlight and the starlight, and to the woods and caves, becoming as shadows and memories, save those who ever and anon set sail into the west and vanished from Middle-earth. But in the dawn of years, elves and men were allies and held themselves akin, and there were some among men that learned the wisdom of the Eldar and became great and valiant among the captains of the Noldor. And in the glory and beauty of the elves, and in their fate, full share had the offspring of elf and mortal, Earendil, and Elwing, and Elrond their child. The Silmarillion by J.R.R. Tolkien, edited by Christopher Tolkien, read by Martin Shaw. return of the Noldor. It has been told that Feanor and his sons came first of the exiles to Middle-earth and landed in the waste of Lammoth, the Great Echo, upon the outer shores of the Firth of Drengist. And even as the Noldor set foot upon the strand, their cries were taken up into the hills and multiplied, so that a clamor as of countless mighty voices filled all the coasts of the north. And the noise of the burning of the ships at Lothgar went down the winds of the sea as a tumult of great wrath. And far away, all who heard that sound were filled with wonder. Now the flames of that burning were seen not only by Fingolfin, whom Feanor had deserted in Ahriman, but also by the orcs and the watchers of Morgoth. No tale has told what Morgoth thought in his heart at the tidings that Feanor, his bitterest foe, had brought a host out of the west. It may be that he feared him little, for he had as yet no proof of the swords of the Noldor, and soon it was seen that he purposed to drive them back into the sea. Under the cold stars before the rising of the moon, the host of Feanor went up the long firth of Drengist that pierced the echoing hills of Ered Lomin, and passed thus from the shores into the great land of Hithlum. And they came at length to the long lake of Mithrim, and upon its northern shore made their encampment in that region that bore the same name. But the host of Morgoth, aroused by the tumult of Lammoth and the light of the burning at Lothgar, came through the passes of Ered Wethrin, the Mountains of Shadow, and assailed Feanor on a sudden before his camp was full wrought or put in defence. And there on the grey fields of Mithrim was fought the second battle in the wars of Beleriand. Dagor Nuin Giliath, it is named, the battle under stars, for the moon had not yet risen, and it is renowned in song. The Noldor, outnumbered and taken at unawares, were yet swiftly victorious, for the light of Aman was not yet dimmed in their eyes, and they were strong and swift and deadly in anger, and their swords were long and terrible. The orcs fled before them, and they were driven forth from Mithrim with great slaughter, and hunted over the Mountains of Shadow into the great plain of Ard Galen, that lay northward of Dorthonion. There the armies of Morgoth that had passed south into the Vale of Sirion and beleaguered Círdan in the havens of the Falas came up to their aid and were caught in their ruin. For Celigorm, Feanor's son, having news of them, waylaid them with a part of the elven host, and coming down upon them out of the hills near Aethel Sirion, drove them into the fen of Serek. Evil indeed were the tidings that came at last to Angband, and Morgoth was dismayed. 10 days that battle lasted, and from it returned of all the hosts that he had prepared for the conquest of Beleriand, no more than a handful of leaves. Yet cause he had for great joy, though it was hidden from him for a while. For Feanor, in his wrath against the enemy, would not halt, but pressed on behind the remnant of the orcs, thinking so as to come at Morgoth himself. And he laughed aloud as he wielded his sword, rejoicing that he had dared the wrath of the Valar and the evils of the road, that he might see the hour of his vengeance. Nothing did he know of Angband or the great strength of defence that Morgoth had so swiftly prepared. But even had he known, it would not have deterred him, for he was fey, consumed by the flame of his own wrath. Thus it was that he drew far ahead of the van of his host, and seeing this, the servants of Morgoth turned to bay, and there issued from Angband Balrogs to aid them. There upon the confines of Dor Daedaloth, the land of Morgoth, Feanor was surrounded with few friends about him. Long he fought on, and undismayed, though he was wrapped in fire and wounded with many wounds. But at the last he was smitten to the ground by Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, whom Ecthelion after slew in Gondolin. There he would have perished, had not his sons in that moment come up with force to his aid, and the Balrogs left him and departed to Angband. Then his sons raised up their father and bore him back towards Mithrim. But as they drew near to Aethel Sirion, and were upon the upward path to the pass over the mountains, Feanor bade them halt, for his wounds were mortal, and he knew that his hour was come. And looking out from the slopes of Ered Wethrin, with his last sight, he beheld far off the peaks of Thangorodrim, mightiest of the towers of Middle-earth, and knew with the foreknowledge of death that no power of the Noldor would ever overthrow them. But he cursed the name of Morgoth thrice, and laid it upon his sons to hold to their oath and to avenge their father. Then he died. But he had neither burial nor tomb, for so fiery was his spirit, that as it sped his body fell to ash, and was borne away like smoke. And his likeness has never again appeared in Arda, neither has his spirit left the halls of Mandos. Thus ended the mightiest of the Noldor, of whose deeds came both their greatest renown and their most grievous woe. Now in Mithrim there dwelt grey elves, folk of Beleriand, that had wandered north over the mountains, and the Noldor met them with gladness, as kinsfolk long sundered. But speech at first was not easy between them, for in their long severance the tongues of the Kalaquendi in Valinor and of the Moraquendi in Beleriand had drawn far apart. From the elves of Mithrim, the Noldor learned of the power of Elu Thingol, king in Doriath, and the girdle of enchantment that fenced his realm. And tidings of these great deeds in the north came south to Menegroth, and to the havens of Brith Umbar and Eglarest. Then all the elves of Beleriand were filled with wonder and with hope at the coming of their mighty kindred, who thus returned unlooked for from the west in the very hour of their need, believing indeed at first that they came as emissaries of the Valar to deliver them. But even in the hour of the death of Feanor, an embassy came to his sons from Morgoth, acknowledging defeat, and offering terms even to the surrender of a Silmaril. Then Maedhros the Tall, the eldest son, persuaded his brothers to feign to treat with Morgoth, and to meet his emissaries at the place appointed. But the Noldor had as little thought of faith as had he. Wherefore each embassy came with greater force than was agreed. But Morgoth sent them more, and they were Balrogs. Maedhros was ambushed, and all his company was slain, but he himself was taken alive by the command of Morgoth, and brought to Angband. Then the brothers of Maedhros drew back and fortified a great camp in Hithlum. But Morgoth held Maedhros as hostage, and sent word that he would not release him unless the Noldor would forsake their war, returning into the west, or else departing far from Beleriand into the south of the world. But the sons of Feanor knew that Morgoth would betray them, and would not release Maedhros, whatsoever they might do. And they were constrained also by their oath, and might not for any cause forsake the war against their enemy. Therefore Morgoth took Maedhros, and hung him from the face of a precipice upon Thangorodrim, and he was caught to the rock by the wrist of his right hand in a band of steel. Now rumour came to the camp in Hithlum of the march of Fingolfin and those that followed him, who had crossed the grinding ice, and all the world lay then in wonder at the coming of the moon. But as the host of Fingolfin marched into Mithrim, the sun rose flaming in the west, and Fingolfin unfurled his blue and silver banners, and blew his horns, and flowers sprang beneath his marching feet, and the ages of the stars were ended. At the uprising of the great light, the servants of Morgoth fled into Angband, and Fingolfin passed unopposed through the fastness of Dor Daedaloth, while his foes hid beneath the earth. Then the elves smote upon the gates of Angband, and the challenge of their trumpets shook the towers of Thangorodrim. And Maedhros heard them, amid his torment, and cried aloud, but his voice was lost in the echoes of the stone. But Fingolfin, being of other temper than Feanor, and wary of the wiles of Morgoth, withdrew from Dor Daedaloth, and turned back towards Mithrim, for he had heard tidings that there he should find the sons of Feanor, and he desired also to have the shield of the Mountains of Shadow while his people rested and grew strong. For he had seen the strength of Angband, and thought not that it would fall to the sound of trumpets only. Therefore, coming at length to Hithlum, he made his first camp and dwellings by the northern shores of Lake Mithrim. No love was there in the hearts of those that followed Fingolfin for the house of Feanor, for the agony of those that endured the crossing of the ice had been great, and Fingolfin held the sons the accomplices of their father. Then there was peril of strife between the hosts. But grievous as were their losses upon the road, the people of Fingolfin and of Finrod, son of Finarfin, were still more numerous than the followers of Feanor, and these now withdrew before them, and removed their dwelling to the southern shore. And the lake lay between them. Many of Feanor's people indeed repented of the burning at Loscar, and were filled with amazement at the valour that had brought the friends whom they had abandoned over the ice of the north. And they would have welcomed them, but they dared not for shame. Thus, because of the curse that lay upon them, the Noldor achieved nothing, while Morgoth hesitated, and the dread of light was new and strong upon the orcs. But Morgoth arose from thought, and seeing the division of his foes, he laughed. In the pits of Angband he caused vast smokes and vapours to be made, and they came forth from the reeking tops of the Iron Mountains, and afar off they could be seen in Mithrim, staining the bright airs in the first mornings of the world. A wind came out of the east and bore them over Hithlum, darkening the new sun, and they fell and coiled about the fields and hollows and lay upon the waters of Mithrim, drear and poisonous. Then Fingon the Valiant, son of Fingolfin, resolved to heal the feud that divided the Noldor, before the enemy should be ready for war. For the earth trembled in the northlands with the thunder of the forges of Morgoth underground. Long before, in the bliss of Valinor, before Melkor was unchained, or lies came between them, Fingon had been close in friendship with Maedhros. And though he knew not yet that Maedhros had not forgotten him at the burning of the ships, the thought of their ancient friendship stung his heart. Therefore he dared a deed which is justly renowned among the feats of the princes of the Noldor. Alone, and without the counsel of any, he set forth in search of Maedhros. And aided by the very darkness that Morgoth had made, he came unseen to the fastness of his foes. High upon the shoulders of Thangorodrim he climbed, and looked in despair upon the desolation of the land. But no passage or crevice could he find through which he might come within Morgoth's stronghold. Then, in defiance of the orcs, who cowered still in the dark vaults beneath the earth, he took his harp and sang a song of Valinor that the Noldor made of old before strife was born among the sons of Finwë. And his voice rang in the mournful hollows that had never heard before aught save cries of fear and woe. Thus Fingon found what he sought, for suddenly above him far and faint his song was taken up, and a voice answering called to him. Maedhros it was that sang amid his torment. But Fingon climbed to the foot of the precipice where his kinsman hung, and then could go no further. And he wept when he saw the cruel device of Morgoth. Maedhros, therefore, being in anguish without hope, begged Fingon to shoot him with his bow. And Fingon strung an arrow and bent his bow, and seeing no better hope, he cried to Manwë, saying, O king to whom all birds are dear, speed now this feathered shaft and recall some pity for the Noldor in their need. His prayer was answered swiftly. For Manwë, to whom all birds are dear, and to whom they bring news upon Taniquetil from Middle-earth, had sent forth the race of eagles, commanding them to dwell in the crags of the north, and to keep watch upon Morgoth. For Manwë still had pity for the exiled elves, and the eagles brought news of much that passed in those days to the sad ears of Manwë. Now, even as Fingon bent his bow, There flew down from the high airs Thorondor, king of eagles, mightiest of all birds that have ever been, whose outstretched wings spanned 30 fathoms. And staying Fingon's hand, he took him up and bore him to the face of the rock where Maedhros hung. But Fingon could not release the hell-wrought bond upon his wrist, nor sever it, nor draw it from the stone. Again, therefore, in his pain, Maedhros begged that he would slay him. But Fingon cut off his hand above the wrist, and Thorondor bore them back to Mithrim. There Maedhros in time was healed, for the fire of life was hot within him, and his strength was of the ancient world, such as those possessed who were nurtured in Valinor. His body recovered from his torment and became hale, but the shadow of his pain was in his heart, and he lived to wield his sword with left hand more deadly than his right had been. By this deed Fingon won great renown, and all the Noldor praised him, and the hatred between the houses of Fingolfin and Feanor was assuaged. For Maedhros begged forgiveness for the desertion in Araman, and he waived his claim to kingship over all the Noldor, saying to Fingolfin, "If there lay no grievance between us, Lord, still the kingship would rightly come to you, the eldest here of the house of Finwë, and not the least wise." But to this his brothers did not all in their hearts agree. Therefore, even as Mandos foretold, the house of Feanor were called the Dispossessed, because the overlordship passed from it, the elder, to the house of Fingolfin, both in Ilenda and in Beleriand, and because also of the loss of the Silmarils. But the Noldor, being again united, set a watch upon the borders of Dor Daedaloth, and Angband was beleaguered from west and south and east. And they sent forth messengers far and wide to explore the countries of Beleriand, and to treat with the people that dwelt there. Now King Thingol welcomed not with a full heart the coming of so many princes in might out of the west, eager for new realms. And he would not open his kingdom, nor remove its girdle of enchantment, for wise with the wisdom of Melian he trusted not that the restraint of Morgoth would endure. Alone of the princes of the Noldor, those of Finarfin's house were suffered to pass within the confines of Doriath, for they could claim close kinship with King Thingol himself, since their mother was Eärwyn of Alqualondë, Olwë's daughter. Angrod, son of Finarfin, was the first of the exiles to come to Menegroth as messenger of his brother Finrod, and he spoke long with the king, telling him of the deeds of the Noldor in the north, and of their numbers, and of the ordering of their force. But being true and wise-hearted, and thinking all griefs now forgiven, he spoke no word concerning the kinslaying, nor of the manner of the exile of the Noldor and the oath of Feanor. King Thingol hearkened to the words of Angrod, and ere he went he said to him, "Thus shall you speak for me to those that sent you. In Hithlum the Noldor have leave to dwell, and in the highlands of Dothonion, and in the lands east of Doriath that are empty and wild. But elsewhere there are many of my people, and I would not have them restrained of their freedom, still less ousted from their homes. Beware, therefore, how you princes of the west bear yourselves. For I am the lord of Beleriand, and all who seek to dwell there shall hear my word. Into Doriath none shall come to abide, but only such as I call as guests, or who seek me in great need." Now the lords of the Noldor held council in Mithrim, and thither came Angrod out of Doriath, bearing the message of King Thingol. Cold seemed its welcome to the Noldor, and the sons of Feanor were angered at the words. But Maedhros laughed, saying, "A king is he that can hold his own, or else his title is vain. Thingol does but grant us lands where his power does not run. Indeed, Doriath alone would be his realm this day, but for the coming of the Noldor. Therefore in Doriath let him reign, and be glad that he has the sons of Finwë for his neighbours, not the orcs of Morgoth that we found. Elsewhere it shall go as seems good to us." But Carinthia, who loved not the sons of Finarfin, and was the harshest of the brothers and the most quick to anger, cried aloud, "Yea, more! Let not the sons of Finarfin run hither and thither with their tails to this dark elf in his caves. Who made them our spokesman to deal with him? And though they may become indeed to Beleriand, and let them not so swiftly forget their father is a lord of the Noldor, though their mother be of other kin." Then Angrod was wrathful, and went forth from the council. Maedhros, indeed, rebuked Carinthia, but the greater part of the Noldor of both followings, hearing his words, were troubled in heart, fearing the fell spirit of the sons of Feanor that it seemed would ever be like to burst forth in rash word or violence. But Maedhros restrained his brothers, and they departed from the council, and soon afterwards they left Mithrim and went eastward beyond Aros to the wide lands about the hill of Himring. That region was named thereafter the March of Maedhros, for northwards there was little defence of hill or river against assault from Angband. There Maedhros and his brothers kept watch, gathering all such people as would come to them, and they had few dealings with their kinsfolk westward, save at need. It is said, indeed, that Maedhros himself devised this plan to lessen the chances of strife, and because he was very willing that the chief peril of assault should fall upon himself. And he remained, for his part, in friendship with the houses of Fingolfin and Finarfin, and would come among them at times for common counsel. Yet he also was bound by the oath, though it slept now for a time. Now the people of Carinthia dwelt furthest east beyond the upper waters of Gelion, about Lake Hellevorn under Mount Rerir, and to the southward. And they climbed the heights of Ered Luin, and looked eastward in wonder, for wild and wide it seemed to them were the lands of Middle-earth. And thus it was that Carinthia's people came upon the dwarves, who, after the onslaught of Morgoth and the coming of the Noldor, had ceased their traffic into Beleriand. But though either people loved skill and were eager to learn, no great love was there between them, for the dwarves were secret and quick to resentment, and Carinthia was haughty and scarce concealed his scorn for the unloveliness of the Naugrim, and his people followed their lord. Nevertheless, since both peoples feared and hated Morgoth, they made alliance, and had of it great profit. For the Naugrim learned many secrets of craft in those days, so that the smiths and masons of Nogrod and Belagost became renowned among their kin, and when the dwarves began again to journey into Beleriand, all the traffic of the dwarf mines passed first through the hands of Carinthia, and thus great riches came to him. When 20 years of the sun had passed, Fingolfin, king of the Noldor, made a great feast, and it was held in the spring near to the pools of Ivrin, whence the swift river Narog rose. For there the lands were green and fair at the feet of the mountains of shadow that shielded them from the north. The joy of that feast was long remembered in later days of sorrow, and it was called Mereth Adathad, the Feast of Reuniting. Thither came many of the chieftains and people of Fingolfin and Finrod, and of the sons of Feanor, Maedhros and Maglor, with warriors of the Eastern March, and there came also great numbers of the Grey Elves, wanderers of the woods of Beleriand, and folk of the Havens, with Círdan their lord. There came even Green Elves from Osiriand, the land of Seven Rivers, far off under the walls of the Blue Mountains. But out of Doriath there came but 2 messengers, Mablung and Daeron, bearing greetings from the king. At Mereth Adarthad many counsels were taken in goodwill, and oaths were sworn of league and friendship, and it is told that at this feast the tongue of the Grey Elves was most spoken even by the Noldor, for they learned swiftly the speech of Beleriand, whereas the Sindar was slow to master the tongue of Valinor. The hearts of the Noldor were high and full of hope, and to many among them it seemed that the words of Feanor had been justified,